kiss. Her lips hit his. She felt his beard on her upper lip, on her chin. She breathed in the scent of him, felt it spread through her chest. He started to pull away, so she held him tighter. Her wine glass fell away. She put her other hand on the back of his head, pulling him even tighter, feeling the texture of his hair between her fingers. He resisted, but only for a moment more. Then she felt his arms around the small of her back, squeezing her tight, lifting her as if she weighed nothing at all. His tongue, cooled by the icy scotch, found hers. She didn't know how long the moment lasted. It lasted a second. It lasted forever. Finally, his strong hand slid to her shoulders, gripped them and pushed her away so that their faces were only an inch apart. She felt the heat of his breath, smelled the talisker that came with it.
"I missed you, Brian. I missed you so much."
Brian sniffed. She gently kissed his left eye, let it linger there.
"I should never have pushed you away," she said.
He nodded. "I shouldn't have let you." Her hand slid to his face, felt his beard in her palms, felt the warmth of his skin.
"I'm not playing stupid games anymore," she said. "I love you. I think I have loved you from the first moment I saw you. The genetics don't change the fact that you're a good man, Brian. They don't change the fact that you're my man."
He closed his eyes. "Everything feels so much. Just more. Before, all my feelings were kind of, I don't know, kind of muted. Now they're on full bore. It's hard to manage."
She kissed his nose. "All I need from you is one emotion. Nothing else matters. Nothing at all. Just look in your heart and tell me, do you love me?"
Her thumb slowly moved back and forth on his cheekbones. He stared at her, his eyes still full of pain, but now also filled with longing. He started to talk, then stopped. He swallowed. He licked his lips, then spoke.
"I love you," he said. "I always have, but I couldn't say it."
She blinked back tears.
"You can say it now. We'll figure this out together. I will never leave you, no matter what happens."
"It's not that easy," he said. "I mean the Zed chromosome. Other people have it and the things that they do. I don't know what I might do."
She kissed him again, hard. His fingertips pressed into her back. Robin pulled away from him only enough to speak, her lips still touching his when she did.
"Stay with me," she said. "Stay with me tonight."
He looked at her again. Then it was his turn to pull her close. Chapter 14. Hands. Just look at them. Holding hands. Kissing. He could see their tongues flicking in and out of each other's mouths. So unclean. The rage built in Tard's chest. So did the excitement. Everything seemed sharper, more intense. From the breeze blowing off the endless ocean, to the sand grinding under his belly, to the smell of a dead fish that couldn't be far off. They couldn't see him. People couldn't see at night, not like he could. And these people had a fire, blazing orange and hot, a spot of light surrounded by this long, dark stretch of beach. Their eyes would be adjusted to that light. They wouldn't be able to see anything 20 feet outside of their little bonfire. Tard could cover 20 feet in just a couple of seconds. They wouldn't have time to react. They probably wouldn't even have time to scream. There was no one to stop him anymore. He'd killed once, and no one had told him to stop. Off in the distance, a few other bonfires lit up the evening fog of Ocean Beach. Probably bums. No one cared about the bums. But these two, they looked like they would be missed. No one was supposed to touch a will-be.
Tard thought about slinking away, maybe looking at the other bonfires to see what was there. But these two, lying there, holding hands, kissing. The boy crawled on top of the girl and started to move. It made Tard feel funny to watch, and that funny feeling made him even angrier. He slowly lifted off his belly and onto his feet, a sand-colored shape that rushed forward, out of the darkness and into the bonfire's light. Chapter 15. Homecoming. Rex let his fingertips trace along rough tunnel walls made of dirt, rocks, mismatched bricks, and half-rotted timbers. The timbers formed steep, inverted V-shapes that supported larger boulders above. The whole thing looked horribly fragile and delicate, as if it might collapse at any moment.
"This doesn't look very safe," he said.
Sly was ahead of him, Pierre behind him, and Servaux and Fort in the rear. Rex didn't need to ride Pierre anymore, nor could he. Pierre had to duck to get through the tight space. The big creature looked up frequently, constantly checking his head height. He seemed quite wary of bumping the timbers above them.
"It's safe," Sly said. "Except for this."
He stopped, pointed to an overhead boulder that had been spray-painted with an orange arrow pointing back the way they had come.
"The tunnels are all set up to collapse if we knock down supporting rocks. We call them linchpins. If you knock this one down, the entire tunnel behind us collapses."
Rex wondered what it would be like to feel all of this weight falling on him, crushing him, suffocating him.
"Why are these here?"
"We have lairs all over the city," Sly said. "But only a few tunnels lead home. If the monster discovers any tunnels, we destroy them so he can't trace the tunnels back to where most of us live."
The linchpin rock looked like it might fall out at any moment.
"Do they ever fall down by themselves?"
Sly smiled.
"Sometimes. That is our existence, being forced to live underground like animals."
"What happens when there's an earthquake?"
Sly shrugged his big, blanket-covered shoulders.
"When there are earthquakes, people die."
He turned and continued back down the tunnel. Rex and the others followed. Rex lost track of how long they walked. The narrow tunnel made for slow going, especially considering the size of Pierre and Fort. Servaux seemed to compress on Fort's shoulders, to flatten somehow, take up less space. At times, Rex had to stoop over and walk in a crouch, which meant Pierre, Fort, even Sly had to crawl through the dirt. It probably explained why their clothes and blankets were so tattered and filthy. Crawling deep in the dirt, like insects, this was no way for his family to live. Finally, the narrow tunnel opened up into a big cavern. Rex stood tall and looked around, amazed at what he saw. The cavern was about as big as a city block. The uneven ceiling rose 30 or 40 feet above him. Dim light filled the space, cast off by assorted light fixtures and naked bulbs attached to any number of things. Chunks of dirty concrete, old logs, a rusted-out old streetcar straight from a gangster movie. And in the middle of the cavern, encrusted with lights of all shapes and sizes, sat a pair of wooden ships. Big ships. They looked old, like the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria he'd learned about in school. Neither ship had masts. The closest one pointed away at an angle, its black hull cracked and broken in 100 places. The bottom was buried in the ground, as if it were sailing a sea of dirt, frozen in time like a movie on pause. The deck angled a little to the left, matching the ship's slight tilt. On the ship's wide back end, Rex saw chewed-up wooden letters that spelled out the name Alamandrolina. To the right of that ship sat the second. This one rolled all the way over on its side, so the ruined deck pointed up at a 45-degree angle. The hull looked barely intact, as if some giant had picked up the whole ship,
lifted it up 100 feet in the air, then dropped it to crack like a melon hitting pavement. He could only make out a few of the letters on the back of this one. An R, then space for 2 missing letters, then an AR, another space, then an O. Rex saw lights coming from inside the ships. Through the cracked hulls he saw beds, walls, and makeshift doors. All these things were level with the ground. People clearly lived in there, even though no one seemed to be home. Some cars were parked in the space between the ships, a battered school bus with windows blacked out, and 2 pickup trucks that looked like they belonged in a scrapyard. All this under the streets of San Francisco? And this place looked old, like it had existed since those ships actually sailed the ocean's waters. A hidden world that had always been here, just waiting for him to find it.
Sly, this is amazing!
This is home,
Sly said.
Welcome to your kingdom.
Rex tried to take it all in. So stunning, so overwhelming. But if this was his kingdom, where were his subjects?
It's empty, he said. I thought there would be more of us.
Sly laughed, a hissing, scraping thing that a few days ago would have made Rex piss in his pants in fear.
There is, Sly said. Tons more. They're in the arena. That's where we're going, to announce to the people that you have come to lead us to a better day.
Sly kept saying that phrase. What did it mean? Maybe it was like in the fantasy novels, where a chosen one led people to overcome evil. If it was a prophecy, Rex hoped he could fulfill it.
The arena, Rex said. How do we get there?
More tunnels. It will take us a little while. When we're there, everyone can see you, and you can see Mommy. Hillary said it was real important you meet Mommy.
Who's Hillary?
Sly grinned his toothy grin.
She's the reason we came to get you, my king. You'll like her, but this won't be all fun. Firstborn will be there. He will not be happy to see you. But don't worry. We will protect you.
Rex looked at Sly, then at Pierre, at Servo and Fort. These men were so big, so strong. How could Firstborn possibly threaten them all? From the tilted ship, an echoing voice called out,
"My king!"
A little man stood on the high rail. As Rex watched, he jumped off and dropped to the ground 20 feet below. The man should have splatted, but he landed on his feet and didn't even slow down. He ran forward, covering the distance faster than Rex would have thought possible.
He's really fast. Marco was fast, too. Is everyone like that?
The man stopped a few feet away. Rex felt the bada-bum-bum in his chest. Such a great feeling. This man was family. He was short, only a few inches taller than Rex. He had a bald head with yellow mottled skin. His nose was so strange, a hooked, hard thing that curved down and out to end in a sharp point. It started out yellow where it grew out of his face, fading to black at the sharp tip. It was more like a beak than a nose. Rex saw 2 little holes above the beak, just below and inside the eyes. Ah, those were his nostrils. The man smiled a wide smile. Behind the wickedly curved beak was a mouth full of tiny, stubby teeth. He wore raggedy clothes, just like the rest, all dirty and smelly and torn up. His right arm was in a white sling. Rex could tell that he was young, like Sly and the others.
"My king! I am Sucka! I have fought and killed for you!"
He stuck out his left hand, the skin there as yellow as his face. He wanted to shake Rex's hand, like Rex was a grown-up or something. Rex shook it. Sly reached out and held Sucka's left shoulder.
"Sucka proved himself my king.
He killed Isaac and the mother of Alex. Then he fought the monster himself.
Rex drew in a surprised breath. You fought the monster? Sukka grinned and nodded.
He shot me with the magic arrow. It was real scary. He would have taken me, but a cop came onto the roof just in time. I jumped away. I haven't healed as quick as normal, but they got the magic arrow out, and now it's getting better.
Sly's green hand mussed Sukka's non-existent hair.
Sukka is a brave one. He'll serve you well.
Sukka's face turned a pale orange. He was blushing. Sly's smile faded. He looked very serious.
My king, are you ready to go to the arena?
It would be dangerous. Firstborn would be waiting, but Rex's new friends would protect him. He nodded.
I am. Take me to meet my people.
Chapter 16. Mommy. The white dungeon led out into a white hallway. The hallway had the same poorly fitted stones, the same countless slathered-on coats of white enamel paint. Mismatched lights lit the curved roof. A thick brown electrical cord, painted over in some parts, ran from light to light, hanging down slightly in some places, nailed up to the ceiling beams in others. Where the ceiling was only stone, the stones looked well-fitted, like the angled blocks of some medieval craftsman. In more places than not, however, random pieces of rock, tile and chunks of wood patched the ceiling in a white enamel kaleidoscope of shapes. Aggie saw smears of blood on the white floor, the path of the boy with no tongue. Hillary pushed Aggie on. They walked past a white-robed man wearing a Richard Nixon mask, the long nose, squinty eyes, and wide grin. The man stood behind a scratched yellow mop bucket that stank of bleach. He swabbed a wet mop across the trail of blood.
Wait, Aggie said. Can I ask a question?
Maybe,
Hillary said. Aggie didn't know what that meant, but she hadn't said no.
What's with the masks? You don't wear one.
Hillary let out a huff of disgust.
Because I am La Reine Procane. The Ouvriers wear the masks in tribute to the guerriers, who risk their lives to bring us food. You understand?
Aggie didn't. Was she speaking Italian? His confusion must have shown on his face. Hillary shook her head, then reached out and pulled off the Nixon mask. As it slid free from under the white hood, Aggie held his breath, expecting to see something horrible. But it was just a man, a light-skinned black man. He stood there, mop still in hand, half-lidded eyes staring out. His mouth hung open. The tip of his tongue was touching the inside of his lower lip.
Hey, Aggie said. Is he retarded?
He's an Ouvrier. He does the work that needs to be done. Now you stop talking and walk, or we'll miss it.
Hillary pushed Aggie in front of her. Each shove was just hard enough to keep him going. But he felt strength every time her hands connected with his body. They moved quickly. He got the feeling she didn't want to be seen. The narrow hall curved and twisted. Soon the white gave way to browns and blacks and grays, the colors of deep earth. Other tunnels branched off. There were no pattern to the branches, no regularity, just a seemingly endless choice of dark options. Stone and brick walkways changed to dirt floors. The hallway widened at one point. When it did, Hillary pushed Aggie into a side tunnel. He walked in, eager to please, but she grabbed him, turned him, and held him so close that they were almost kissing.
What you see now, no one sees, she said. You be very quiet. Go where I tell you. You make one noise, they will tear you to pieces. Understand?
Aggie nodded. She pushed him through a hall so cramped he had to turn sideways to fit. Dirt and stone ground up against his face and chest. The walls here looked like an archaeological dig. Dirt and stone, sure, but also blackened wooden boards, rotted timbers,
worn bits of broken glass bottles, ceramic shards and rusty metal from old tools, gas cans and pipes. This was a tunnel dug by layman's hands, carved through old landfill. The junk hallway led up at an angle steep enough to make him winded after only 20 steps. As he climbed, a heavy scent started to fill the air. It wasn't a perfume. It was thicker, more animal. He stopped to breathe it deep into his nose. Whatever it was, he couldn't get enough of it. Hillary pushed him.
Hurry, you must see this.
He kept climbing. Of all things, his dick twitched. He couldn't possibly be horny at a time like this, could he? The floor leveled out. Aggie found himself in a tiny room with a ceiling so low that he had to crawl in on his hands and knees. The floor was a random collection of metal grates and old jail cell bars set into the ground. He could look through them into the dark void below. Hillary leaned in close to his ear.
"We made it in time,"
he whispered back.
"Made it for what?"
"To see what will happen to you if you don't do what I say."
A tiny light appeared below, a single candle, carried by a white-robed man. This one wore the mask of a twisted, smiling demon. Aggie saw the floor was perhaps 10 feet below the grates. He was close enough that if he reached through the bars and stretched, he might be able to touch the top of the masked man's hood. Another white-robed masked man entered, also carrying a candle. Then another, and another. The candles began to chase away the darkness, revealing a rectangular room maybe 20 feet long by 15 across. At one end of the room, the feeble light illuminated a patchwork tarp that covered something big, a mound about the size of an elephant lying on its side. More candle-carrying white-robed masked men entered. They walked through a narrow door that was in the middle of one of the long walls. The door appeared to be the only way in or out. Aggie saw that the earlier masked men were leaving, saw that it was a procession. They entered, found a place to set their candles, then quietly shuffled out. The room grew brighter, as did the flickering light playing off the patchwork tarp. One end of the tarp moved. From that end, Aggie heard the moan of a woman. A masked man ran to the tarp's opposite end. It reached under, picked something up, then stood, holding that something tight to its chest. What was that stain on his white robe? Was it blood? Fresh blood? The masked man pushed past his own kind and left the room. Hillary grabbed his ear, twisted it.
"Make no noise. If they see you, you die."
That strange smell intensified. Aggie's face felt hot. His dick started to stiffen. The stream of incoming masked men set their candles down on shelves, on a table, on the floor, on whatever space was available. Then they turned and walked out, sliding past other masked men who were bringing in more candles. The room grew brighter. Music started playing, a thin, plinking, metallic melody. Aggie looked to the side of the room opposite the mound. A white-robed man was sitting there at a white wooden table. Another masked man walked up to it, this one holding a metal stand with 8 candles, all tall and parallel, a candelabra. And wait, it wasn't a table, it was a little piano, like a smaller version of one of those big grand pianos. A second candelabra joined the first. Now there was enough light that Aggie could see the piano player wore a Donald Duck mask. The small piano wasn't really white, but more of a pale yellow. The paint chewed up and scarred, chips showing the dark wood beneath. Aggie's hands locked onto the iron bars holding him aloft. His dick was fully erect now, pushing out his second-hand pajamas. Not just erect, it was so hard it hurt. More candles. The room grew brighter still. Wait, was the entire tarp moving? Hillary's hot breath on his ear.
"Now they bring the groom."
Her lips were so close. Her breath sent hot tingles up his spine. He wanted her. his throbbing cock calling out to him to take her. But how could he want this old crone who kept him prisoner? The music grew louder. It wasn't a piano. It was harsher, tinnier. He knew that sound. He'd heard it in an old TV show. The Addams Family. It was a harpsichord. The white-robed Donald Duck started to rock back and forth as he worked the chipped keys. More candles. More light. That tarp was moving. Not just the end. Oh, no. Oh, dear Jesus. The whole thing was moving. What the fuck is underneath that thing? It can't be alive. It just can't. Because it's so big as an elephant. What is it? What is it? The squeaking of wheels. A dolly, the kind movers use, rolled in through the narrow door, pushed by a white-robed man. And strapped to that dolly, the boy with no tongue. The light of at least 100 candles flickered off the blond-haired boy's blood-covered mouth, his jaw, his neck, his shirt. He cried with big heaving sobs that shook his thick chest. The boy, he had a boner? Even from here, the boy's erection was clearly visible under his pajamas. The masked men gathered at the tarp, ruffling it, preparing to remove it. The flapping of the giant cloth sent waves of that smell shooting up to Aggie's nose. He had to blink away the lust, had to press his face between the cold iron bars beneath him, had to fight the pure heat that roiled through his body.
"You do what I say,"
Hillary whispered in his ear,
"or it will be you that experiences Mommy's love."
The harpsichord's plinking tones filled the air. The masked men yanked the tarp away. Aggie reared back. His stomach churned, tried to push his last meal up into his throat. Bloated, huge, a mass of white flesh like a giant scoop of lard held together with pockmarked skin. Were those legs? They were. So fat they looked like giant gray-white sausages with tiny feet. Two small doll parts affixed to the corpulent body that spilled out under them, around them, and above the legs, a bubble of a belly arcing close to the ceiling. A belly that seemed almost translucent, that twitched and wiggled every time the body moved. If there was a head and arms, they were hidden somewhere behind the fat. The feet kicked uselessly, like those of a new baby trying out its new muscles. Aggie had been told not to make any noise. He opened his mouth and clamped his teeth on the iron bar below him. The metal felt cold on his lips. He tasted rust. His jaws squeezed harder and harder until he heard his right molar crack. The pain felt like a burning nail driven into his jaw, but it cleared his mind a little bit. It stopped him from screaming. White-robed men circled the thing. Aggie realized that it was lying on a thick table. No, on a cart, with black car tires mounted at the corners. The kicking feet hung suspended over one end. Six masked men moved near those feet, three at each corner. They reached underneath and came out with big T-bars that they slid into rusty fixtures mounted on the cart. The men leaned back hard and started to pull. More white-robed men squeezed in between the wall and the back of the cart. They pushed with all their combined weight. The cart rolled slowly, the old wood floor groaning beneath the tires. The masked men slowly turned the cart, moving it away from the wall until the end with the feet faced the strapped-up boy with no tongue. The harpsichord played louder. The white-robed men in the room started to sway and moan in unison. Aggie felt a piece of tooth floating in his mouth. He swallowed it. He saw the body in profile, a giant slug made of human flesh. Now he saw the arms, at least the right one, endless waves of fat so thick he couldn't make out the forearm from the upper arm.
Vene a moi, mon amoureux,
said a deep, resonant voice that rang with erotic promise. The voice had come from the body on the cart. Aggie looked left, beyond the bell curve of the bloated belly and elephantine chest. He saw the head, and knew this was the mommy that Hillary had brought him to see. Aggie James started to whine. Hillary flicked him on the ear, hard. The stinging pain again helped him hold on to some semblance of sanity. Her head. Oh, good God, her head was inside some kind of box. A metal, leather, and wood box affixed to the cart. Bloated shoulder meat swelled up and around the rig. She was so morbidly obese that without it, Aggie knew her own fat would engulf her head and suffocate her. A few stringy brown strands of hair clung to a head wrinkled with deep rolls.
Venez à moi, mon amour,
Mommy said. The light of 100 candles played off of her white skin. Not pale, but actually white, like a grub dug up from the dirt, a grub that had never felt the heat of the sun. There seemed to be a glow from within her swollen stomach. Aggie realized he could see through her belly, just a little bit, the translucent skin and tangle of veins pink backlit by dancing candle flames on the other side. Inside that belly, he saw something moving. Several somethings. Fetuses. A dozen? 2 dozen? Some twitched. Some kicked. But most didn't move at all. They were just still. Black dots inside that horrific parody of a fleshy water balloon. A white-robed man walked to the boy's dolly. He tilted it back, then moved the boy toward Mommy's legs. The boy started to scream.
Mon chéri,
Mommy said. A baby slid from between her legs in a splash of fluid. It wedged between the wet fat of her thighs. Bile filled Aggie's mouth. He forced himself to swallow it down, lest it spray out and land on the white-robed men below. The baby didn't move. Its tan skin contrasted with her gray-white flesh. A masked man rushed in and pulled the still fetus out from between her tree-trunk-sized legs. The blonde boy's screaming changed to rapid-fire syllables. He was begging, but had no tongue to form the words. The masked man behind the dolly reached around and stuffed a rag in the boy's mouth, muffling the sounds. The masked man then pulled down the boy's pajama pants. He tilted the dolly back again and rolled it between Mommy's legs. Aggie felt Hillary's hand on the back of his neck, strong, ready to snap his spine if he got noisy. The message was clear. You ain't seen nothing yet, and when you do, keep your fucking mouth shut.
Now, Hillary hissed. Marie Lettrelle takes a husband.
The white-robed men moaned louder. The harpsichord played faster. Mommy's head thrashed inside its metal and wood box.
Mon chéri,
she said. Her stubby legs reached out, wrapped around the back of the dolly, and pulled the boy into her. Her fat surrounded him. He looked like he was standing in waist-deep curdled milk. The boy with no tongue lurched against the ropes holding him fast to the dolly. His struggles did no good.
Mon chéri, mon chéri.
Hillary's hand tightened on Aggie's neck. She leaned forward, inadvertently pushing his head into the rusty iron bars. He reached back and spasmodically pulled at her dress. She relaxed the grip, but didn't let go.
Tonight the king will come to her, she whispered. We will be saved.
Mommy's legs contracted over and over, pulling the boy into her, making the dolly rattle. Her obscene mass jiggled in time. The smell. The smell that made Aggie so hot, so hard. It cranked up to a new level, filling the room, filling his head. Aggie twitched once, then came in his pajamas. The boy's scream changed, briefly, from one of terror to one of horrified ecstasy. The harpsichord music stopped. Aggie blinked. The heat dissipated from his head, his body. He pushed his face away from the iron bars. He couldn't look at the scene anymore, not for another second. He turned and put his lips to Hillary's ear.
I'll do whatever you say, anything. Don't let that happen to me, please.
Hillary turned to face him. She smiled, the candlelight from below gleaming off what yellow teeth remained. She held his face, fingertips gently stroking his cheeks. She leaned in.
It is not over for him. You have one more thing to see. Now, Mommy's husband will do the groom's walk.
Chapter 17. The Groom's Walk. Hillary told Aggie to get up. He did so, carefully, lest his feet slip through the bars and that thing below know he was there. She guided him back out the way they had come. As they exited, Aggie heard the hum of machinery, then a distant, heavy click. One last peek down through the bars showed a strong light coming through the door to Mommy's room. Fully lit, Aggie saw wooden floors and walls that were black with age. Hillary pushed Aggie through more narrow tunnels until they reached thin, well-worn stone steps that led up. After 40 or 50 steps, the path leveled out into yet another confined tunnel. But this one led to an open space. In that space, the flicker of torches. Hillary stopped him just before the opening. She reached into a hole in the dirt wall and pulled out a filthy, gray felt poncho with a hood. She put it on him as if he were a 3-year-old. The fabric reeked of mildew and of strange, sour body odors. She reached into the hole again and pulled out a moth-eaten, moldy plaid sleeping bag. She wrapped this around his shoulders, obscuring his shape. Even at his worst moments as a human, sleeping in gutters filled with dirty rainwater, going weeks without bathing, pissing on himself, maybe even shitting himself, he'd never smelled this bad. She led him out on a flat ledge made of rocks, old timbers, what looked like a dented highway sign, and other pieces of societal refuse. Before him sprawled a huge oblong space, maybe 300 feet long, by 200 feet wide. The ledge ran all the way around, a path 4 or 5 feet wide that dropped off into the open space 30 feet below. Seats of all kinds lined the edge, folding metal chairs, plastic chairs, benches, logs, barrels, buckets, hundreds of them, all near the edge so people could sit and look down to the cavern floor. Behind those seats, running along the back of the ledge, he saw many dark spaces, tunnels that led deeper into whatever hell he found himself in. A curved, uneven ceiling of dirt and rocks arced above. Hillary led him to the edge and made him sit on the old highway sign. His feet dangled in open air. Down below and to his left, at one end of the oblong cavern, he saw the wreck of a huge wooden sailing ship, the kind he'd seen in those pirate movies. The ship's bottom sat on a little plateau of sorts that held it aloft from the cavern floor. The long wooden prow pointed to the other end of the oblong space, while the rear of the ship seemed to be buried in the cavern's wall. Aggie had never seen anything that seemed so out of place. The ship's deck looked uneven, but was mostly intact. Some of the chewed-up railings still lined the edges. He saw hatches in the deck, hatches that appeared to be well used, as if they still led down to areas below. A mast reached up from the ship's center, a mast made of human skulls. The top of the mast was at Aggie's eye level, 30 feet above the deck, topped by a crossbeam that turned it into a giant T. A combination of burning torches and blazing, mismatched electrical lights clustered at each end of the crossbeam, illuminating the deck below. At the back of the ship, where steps should have led to a higher rear deck, the wreck merged into the cavern wall, as if excavators hadn't quite finished the job. A door at the deck's back end looked like it would have led under that hidden second deck. Through that door, Aggie saw a glimpse of something white and slug-like. Mommy. Aggie put it all together. Mommy lived in the captain's cabin of an old wooden sailing ship. Hillary's people had put in jail cell bars and metal grates in the ceiling of that cabin, so that people could look down at Mommy But how could a big ship like that get underground? Just where the hell was he? He saw that the cavern's floor wasn't solid. The sides of the mound holding the ship aloft sloped down to a series of dirt trenches that wound in every direction, running all the way to the end of the cavern, and also stretching from side to side. The trenches twisted and intersected. They looked to be about 10 feet deep, varying from maybe 5 to 8 feet wide. From his spot high up on the ledge, Aggie could see into most of the trenches near him. He couldn't see into the ones on the far side unless they pointed right at his position. He realized what the trenches were. A maze. He shuddered, imagining wandering through those spaces, wondered what might chase him. A flash of gold caught his eye. On the ledge directly above Mommy's cabin, he saw a golden throne padded with red velvet cushions. Everything in this cavern looked dirty, used, rejected, and beat up. But not the golden throne. It radiated an aura of importance.
Hillary, what is this place?
The arena, she said. It is very important to us.
She patted him on the back as if they were old buddies, as if they were two kids sitting on a bridge during some idyllic summer afternoon.
Now you will see why you must help me.
Like she needed to show him anything more?
I'll do whatever you say, I swear to God. I just need to get out of here.
Hillary patted him again.
Just watch.
Movement from the captain's cabin door drew his attention. Masked men wheeled out the boy with no tongue, still strapped to his dolly. His pajama bottoms had been pulled back up. The thin fabric clung to him, matted down by Mommy's wetness. Another masked man walked out of Mommy's cabin. His white, red-eyed mask had exaggerated cheekbones decorated with red spirals. In his hands, he held a trumpet.
Now the call, Hillary said.
The masked man lifted the trumpet and blew a long, low note. When he stopped, the note echoed briefly, the tone slapping back and forth from cavern walls made of dirt and rock and brick. In the shadowy tunnels that opened onto the ledge, Aggie saw movement. People filtered out and started sitting in the seats. No, not people. Creatures. Some wore heavy blankets draped over their heads and bodies, but far more wore normal clothes. Jeans or shorts or sweatpants. T-shirts, sweat tops, dresses, tattered suit jackets. The various pieces of clothing covered so many shapes. Horrific shapes. He saw skin of all colors, the gloss of fur, the gleam of hard shells, the winking of oozing wetness.
Yes, Hillary said. Everyone comes. Oh, look.
She pointed across the arena to the far side.
I see Sly and Pierre. They are the ones that brought you in. Isn't that nice?
On the opposite side of the oblong ledge, 200 feet away, Aggie saw a thick man with a face like a snake. Next to him, a taller man with a dog face. Behind them, someone so big the size seemed incomprehensible. And between these three, a tiny form hidden inside a blanket. Aggie felt the presence of people on either side. He slowly turned to his right. Not 10 feet away sat a stubby, bleach-white man with snake-like hair that seemed a wave of its own accord. The man turned toward Aggie, but Aggie looked away quick and pulled his blanket up higher to hide his face. He couldn't stop himself from a peek to the left. Only 5 feet away, something that looked like a man-sized cockroach. Hillary nudged Aggie.
"Best if you look straight ahead," she said quietly.
Aggie did just that. The trumpet player blew a three-note blast, then walked back into the cabin. Everyone on the ledge stood and looked to Aggie's left, to the golden throne. From the shadows behind that throne, figures emerged. The first wore a brown trench coat. He had a massively oversized head, with an even more oversized forehead, the skin there gnarled and wrinkly. He stood on the throne's right side. A woman walked out to stand on the throne's left. She had long, glossy black hair that spilled over both shoulders. Even from this far away, Aggie could see that she was beautiful. She wore knee-high rubber boots, shiny pants, and a cut-off Oakland Raiders sweatshirt that revealed a flat stomach. Something dangled from each hip. Were those coiled chains? A tattered brown blanket hung down her back, secured by a white rope around her neck.
"Bonehead and Sparky,"
Hillary said.
"They are Firstborn's gods."
Her tone had changed. She no longer sounded happy. She sounded disgusted, bitter.
"And here he comes, our beloved leader."
A tall man walked out of the shadows. He wore a long black fur coat clasped at the neck with something that gleamed like silver. Aggie saw blue jeans tucked into black combat boots, a black gun holster strapped to each thigh. The creature wore no shirt. Short black fur covered a six-pack and a lean, defined physique. When he moved, his muscles twitched like those of a panther. The face looked vaguely cat-like, with long, slanted eyes and green irises, a slightly extended mouth, and large ears that angled back against the blocky head. He moved to the front of the throne, every motion smooth and easy. He sat. Hillary's lip curled into a sneer.
"Firstborn has decided to grace us with his presence. Now we may begin."
Down on the ship, masked men moved the boy with no tongue. They rolled him to the center of the smashed deck and rested his dolly against the mast of skulls. The mast's combination of burning torches and blazing naked electric lights cast harsh, flickering shadows on his terrified face. Less than an hour ago, that boy had been in the white dungeon with Aggie. "Hillary, what happens to him now?" She smiled.
"Now the children come out to play."
Halfway between the mast and the prow, a hatch wiggled. A black-gloved, white-sleeved arm pushed it open. Two little kids climbed out. Hillary let out a breathy,
"Aw,"
then slapped Aggie's leg.
"They are so cute."
Just kids. A boy and a girl, maybe 3 or 4 years old. They wore filthy second-hand pajamas. The boy was white and blonde. He could have been any of the rich little brats from the marina part of town. His shirt had the faded remains of a San Francisco 49ers pattern. The girl had darker skin and red hair. Her pajamas were blue, with a flopping, almost-off iron-on of Barney. Even from his perch over 100 feet away, he could see that both of them held something metallic in each tiny, dirty little hand. They moved a few feet from the hatch. As they did, the lights played off the metal enough for Aggie to realize what it was they carried. Each of them held a fork and a knife. More kids crawled out, but these weren't even remotely human. One looked like a wrinkled yellow bat. Another had a bumpy shell, with fingers as long as its whole arm, and a huge, hard, long thumb that formed something like a crab claw. Still another resembled a little white-furred, red-eyed gorilla. That one wore a Sesame Street t-shirt and red flannel pajama bottoms. These creatures waited with the blonde boy and the red-haired girl. More creatures came out behind them, but Aggie had to look away. He'd seen enough. Two white-robed, masked men walked toward the boy with no tongue. They undid his restraints. He fell forward. A masked man knelt and tapped the boy on the shoulder, then pointed to the right side of the ship, the side facing Aggie. The boy looked that way. Aggie saw the object of attention, a ladder leading down into the trenches. The masked men hurried their dolly to another hatch halfway between the mast and Mommy's cabin. They lowered the dolly, crawled inside, and pulled the hatch shut behind them. The boy with no tongue stood up. Aggie saw muscles under those pajamas. The teenager looked around, clearly stunned by the cavern's breadth and strangeness. Then his eyes fell upon the small monsters. From inside Mommy's cabin, the hidden trumpeter played a long, single note. The boy with no tongue ran for the ladder. He grabbed it and scrambled down, athletic and graceful if a bit sluggish. He hit the bottom and sprinted down a maze trench. The crowd suddenly cheered, a sound just like every sporting event Aggie had ever seen. Like a pack of tiny wolves, the children rushed to the side of the deck. Tumbling, little kid running carried them forward, pajama-clad feet zipping across the dirty wood. They didn't bother with the ladder. They just leaped, dropping 15 feet down to the uneven trench floors below. Some landed gracefully. Others hit hard in a clumsy mess of arms and legs. The children screamed and laughed, stepping over each other to chase after the boy with no tongue. Hillary giggled an old woman's giggle. She clapped her hands.
Oh, so cute!
The teenager sprinted through the trenches. He banked left and right, without pattern or thought, sometimes turning a corner so fast his momentum would slam him into a wall. Pieces of rock and dirt fell wherever he hit. A trail of dust followed behind him, almost as if he were smoldering. Sometimes the trench walls obscured any sight of him, and sometimes Aggie could see all of the terrified boy. The chasing children split up and rushed down different trenches, little feet pounding away in pursuit. Hillary pointed toward the one with the long fingers and the pointy thumb.
"Crabapple Bob is my favorite," she said. "He's a nice boy. I hope he gets the groom."
She sounded like any old aunt or grandmother watching kids run and play, like this was nothing more than an Easter egg hunt, and she was rooting for her favorite to find a hidden chocolate bunny. The teenager turned down a trench that led straight toward Aggie's spot. Aggie saw the look of panic on the kid's face, the wide-eyed stare, the open mouth, the blood-streaked chin, the snot hanging from his nose and trailing across his cheek. And from this angle, Aggie saw the little blonde boy with the faded 49er shirt coming down an intersecting trench from the left. The little boy turned the corner to block the teenager's path, then raised his fork and knife. The crowd cheered in excitement. The teenager didn't slow a bit. He kicked out with all the strength of a muscular, nearly full-grown man. His foot smashed into the little boy's face, throwing his tiny body backward and into a trench wall. Blood instantly poured from the kid's mouth. The crowd booed.
"Oh, that's too bad," Hillary said. "I like little Emil."
The teenager's running kick had thrown him off balance. He stumbled, then fell to his knees, hands skidding across the rock-strewn path. From behind him came the bat thing and the nightmarish crabapple Bob. Hillary clapped.
"Go, Bob!"
The teenager scrambled to his feet. Blood poured from his left knee. He hopped in a mad lurch that threatened to spill him to the ground again. Kids closed in from trenches on the left and on the right, a mass of shapes and colors, the glint of forks and knives reflecting the flickering torchlight, the happy squeals of children at play. The gorilla boy came from the left, running fast on all fours to pass the others. At an intersection, he shot out and tackled the hopping teenage boy. Together they tumbled into a trench wall, kicking up a cloud of dust and dirt. Crabapple Bob and the bat thing dove on the pile. The teenager punched and kicked. The little monster stabbed. The rest of the children poured in, burying the teenager beneath a pile of twisted, tiny bodies. Forks and knives rose up and down, flashing clean at first, then trailing arcs of blood. Aggie watched. That could have easily been him down there.
"Why?" he croaked from a dry throat. "Why would you do this?"
"Well, they have to learn how to hunt, don't they? They have to get the taste."
Aggie saw the little red-haired girl dart out of the swarm. She held a bloody, severed hand. She ran away from the pack, giggling and gnawing on the thumb, like a kid working a caramel apple.
"They're eating him,"
Aggie said, managing to yell without yelling, to pack all his panic and horror into a hissing whisper. Down in the trenches, body parts came loose. A curl of intestine flipped up, arced wetly, then fell on top of something that looked like a blue-furred wolf boy wearing a Hannah Montana sweatshirt. Blood spread across the trench floor, turning it into red mud. The giggling kids tore at the body, played in the blood mud like any child in any sandbox anywhere in the world. Hillary sighed.
Ah, they always get so dirty.
A swarm of masked men, hundreds of them, ran through the trenches and closed in on the kids, white robes swishing with each step. Some of them carried hacksaws. They rushed to the mass of bloody, muddy children, pulled them off, and held them up, while little hands and feet kicked in protest. Aggie had a brief glimpse of the teenager's body, pajamas soaked head to toe in blood, right shoulder ripped open, left foot gone, intestine strings spread about and trampled flat into the dirt. The masked men went to work with the hacksaws. Aggie felt eyes upon him. He turned his head to the right, as little as possible, and looked out of the corner of his eye. The man with the snake hair was staring right at him. A tap on his shoulder, Hillary's mouth near his ear.
Follow me. They have smelled something on you. Keep your eyes toward the ground and make no noise, or you will wind up as the next groom.
He felt her hands pulling up his blanket, hiding his head and face. It reminded him of being a small child when his mother would adjust his jacket for him to make sure he stayed warm. Aggie stood. He kept his eyes cast down as instructed. He followed Hillary's feet. With each step, he waited for hands to grab him, yank him back, toss him down into the cavern floor where the children would dig into him with forks and knives. He barely breathed until he again slid into the tunnel from which they'd come, leaving the ledge behind. Hillary, what happens now?
Now they cut up the groom to make the stew, except for the brains. Crabapple Bob gets to feed those to Mommy. Or maybe they think Vanilla Gorilla got the kill. Either way, we will have much stew tonight.
Stew. The Tupperware. Aggie had been eating people. The realization should have shocked him, he knew. But he'd seen more than he could handle, and he just didn't give a fuck. As long as he got out of here, it didn't matter at all. No, Hillary, what I meant was, what do I have to do so I don't wind up as stew? They exited the narrow tunnel into the hodgepodge hall that led back to the white room. Hillary gave him a missing tooth smile, her eyelids and cheeks crinkling so deeply he would have thought her blind.
Oh, that, she said. All you have to do is deliver something for me. Then you are free.
Free. Just the thought of it. He would deliver whatever she wanted, no matter what the risk. They reached the white room. It shocked Aggie that he was actually relieved to see it, to once again be locked behind those white bars. For the moment, he had the place to himself, but he knew more prisoners would come. Aggie could only hope that when the masked men brought in the next bum or illegal, he wouldn't be there to see it. Chapter 18. Long Live the King. So many. All along the ledge, down in the trenches, on the cracked deck of the old shipwreck. His people. His kind. How had he gone his whole life without knowing this feeling? His heart felt like it might swell up and choke him, push his lungs out of his chest. So much love.
Sly, I don't know what to do.
A big, strong hand on his shoulder.
We've got your back, my king. Everyone is here. This is your time. Are you ready?
Rex glanced to the right, to the ship cabin and the ledge above it where Firstborn sat in his golden throne. If Rex was going to claim his birthright, he'd have to face that frightening creature in the fur-lined cape. Rex took a deep breath, then nodded.
I'm ready. Yes, let's do this.
Can you jump?
Rex looked over the edge, at least a 30-foot drop to the meandering trenches below.
I can't jump there. That would kill me.
The big hand patted his back lightly.